So I'm delighted that Mr. Justice Harry Gaty is here to reflect with us a little bit. I have known a couple lawyers in my life and had the occasion to speak with them. I've always been struck by the extraordinary position that that occupies in our society, and the kind of demand it places upon a human being who takes on that responsibility on behalf of the civil life and on behalf of our whole legal tradition. It seems to me to be one of the most personally challenging vocations that a person can have. All vocations are challenging, of course. They all have their particular character. But sitting on the bench, sitting on the cathedra, sitting in the place of judgment, participates in a very ancient tradition where someone, in the end, has to decide. And often, what they are given in that position, what the options are in that position, must, it seems to me, not having been in that position, must at times feel so limited and so dull an instrument, given the human drama that is played out before them all the time. And in my conversations with Harry over the last few years, I have actually heard that struggle a bit. And so I'm delighted you've come to talk about how you have come to be who you are.
Well, we're a small group here, and most of you know me fairly well. And I was thinking of a story that I'd heard once about a young minister coming to a parish. And Sunday morning, only one farmer showed up. And he waited a while, and nobody else came. So he stood up in the pulpit and gave his whole sermon. And I can't remember exactly how it goes, but then he asked the farmer what he thought about it, and the farmer said, well, if only one cow shows up, I don't feed him the whole load. So I have I've written out what I was trying to tell you, and it's a little on the long side, perhaps, and I could email it to all of you and just jump right into some of the questions that you might have about the area. What my talk was basically about is how I got to this extraordinary position of being a lawyer and a judge, based on my early background. I mean, it's like a miracle.
Well, tell us a bit about it.
Yeah.
Before we jump in.
Describe the miracle.
Well, there were several miracles. I'll let you read about the basic. My parents were very poor. And we, I'll just say, when we moved to Edmonton when I was going into grade 7, my dad was a mechanic, and there was no money around. So it was very tough, and there were 5 children in our family. And my mother, 5 children born in 7 years. And I never really realized at 5 years old why I was shipped out to my grandmother. But I have recently learned that I'm an ADHD child. And once you're ADHD, you're ADHD for life. And it explained a lot of things.
You only realized that recently.
Yeah. When I started reading about it, because on statistics I saw on TV, 40% of ADHD children's parents, there's a 40% chance that the parent has ADHD. So it runs in the family, and I can see that's my grandmother, my grandfather on my mother's side probably was ADHD. Anyway, so at a very early age, at 5 years old, I was thumbing a ride from Rocky Mountain, the farm 5 miles out of Rocky Mountain, I was in the Rocky Mountain House. And one of the stories I've told is my grandfather's farm was about a quarter mile from Highway 11, which was just a little dirt road, gravel road. And we walked to the end of the quarter mile, and then he said, "You stay here and put out your thumb." And then he walked ahead about 100 yards, not explaining to a five-year-old kid what the plan was. So I stuck out my thumb. I felt totally rejected, got picked up, and waved to him as we passed. I guess I was supposed to tell. I'm guessing that the plan was that I was supposed to tell the guy, "That's my grandpa. Could you pick him up?" So I, as you can see, I'm a slow learner. So we get to Edmonton. My parents are living on the outskirts of Edmonton because we were poor. And the rents were cheaper. We lived in an old farmhouse. So then when my mother, when my sister Judy, who I just came back from Denmark, she's 8 years younger than I am, seven and a half years younger than I am. When she was ready to go to school, my mother could get a job. So she got a job as a chambermaid at the McDonald's Hotel. The key miracle at this stage is by the time I reached grade high school, we were just inside the catchment area of Westbound High School. Westbound High School was the top school in Edmonton. Small school, 400 students. Most of the kids there were doctors, lawyers, professionals, people from Illinois and whatnot. But I was across the tracks. And so there were a few of us, and as I say in my paper, from immigrant families, from poor people who were living on the edge of town. And those of us who were fortunate enough to go to West Plain inculcated the value system of our friends, and where the expectation was that you would go to university. And so, in the back of my mind, of course, I thought I could go to university. So in my grade 12 year, now you'll read in my paper, I was not a very good student. I did enough to get through, but I didn't get my senior matric because I wasn't taking French 30. So in my senior year, over the Easter period, I was 17 years old, I had applied to the Air Force ROTP program, Reserve Officer, a regular officer training program. And so they sent me to Centralia, Ontario, for a week of testing over the Easter period. And fortunately, I was selected. I guess I did well enough in their exams to be selected for ROTP. Conditional on my getting French 30, which meant I would have to go to summer school. Well, my parents had, in my grade 12 year, my parents moved to Camrose. We had a 48 Ford. My dad had a 48 Ford. He's a mechanic. And we had to tie a string to the clutch to pull it up. And that car wasn't worth enough to take to Camrose when they moved to Camrose. I stayed in Edmonton and finished my grade 12 year. Barely got through. I got a 51 in trigonometry. And of course, no French. So my marks were not good. I had an average that was over 60, which was the minimum average for university. Well, when it became clear that there was no hope of me going to summer school in Red Deer, I decided, well, I better apply to the Air Force. Well, the reason I was interested in the Air Force was when I was a young child in Calgary, right after the war, or right during the war, the training plane, the Harbors from High River and areas down there would be flying around. So I always wanted to be a fighter pilot. So that's got me interested in the Air Force. And then when I was about 13 years old, one of my friends said, why don't you join Air Cadets? So I joined Air Cadets in Edmonton. And that was a lot of fun. In fact, I was in probably the last troop train in Canada. This was a troop train of Air Cadets from the Western provinces. There was nobody but Air Cadets and their leaders on board this train from Manitoba to Saskatchewan to Abbotsford, B.C. So, first time I get out of Alberta. It was an incredible experience, really, you know. So I had that Air Cadet experience. So when I'm 16 years old, I have the opportunity to join the 418 Air Force Reserve Squadron, which were flying B-25 bombers. And my job then was to fill, it was just like with my dad's service station, I filled the gas tank in the plane with fuel. But I got a couple of rides in the plane. So here I am, I have this Air Force experience, you know, I'm an Air Cadets, 418 Squadron, and since I can't get into ROTP, I better join the regular Air Force. So I do, and again, I'm very fortunate, I get into air crew. 19 years old, I'm an officer, making more money than my dad ever made in wages, and having to support five kids. So I spent 6 years in the Air Force, and I got on to squadron in Saint-Hubert, Quebec, and over half my squadron mates had university degrees. So a vocation in the Air Force was not a possibility. If I expected to go anywhere, I would have to go to university. So after the 6 years, I decide university is where I'm going. But being a very naive kid, I don't know if this has something to do with ADHD, but your mind just doesn't work the way other people's does. So
don't blame it on ADHD,
Mary. No, huh? No,
it'll test you.
And that's a compliment.
Yes.
It's not being gay.
Well, not too.
So my 6 years wasn't to expire until October. Well, school, university was starting at the beginning of September, so I was able to get a 1 month early release. And they let me go in time so that by the time I got to Edmonton, I was only 3 days late. Registration had been over. School had already been in session for 3 days. And I go up and say I'm ready to go to university. And another great miracle happens in my life. I don't know, you know, because I was sent to various receptionists to talk to somebody. And finally, this receptionist, I go into the arts area, and the receptionist says, you've got to speak to the dean. So I go up and speak to the dean. And he says, you want to go to university? I said, yeah, I'm ready to go. I'm motivated. And he said, have you applied? I said, no, I didn't know you had to apply.
Just show up.
Oh, bless you.
So he's talking to me. He says, well, do you have a transcript of your marks? Yes, I have my transcript from that sent to me 6 years earlier. You know, so I haul out this piece of paper, and he looks at it. He didn't do very well in math. And you don't have your language requirement. I said, well, yeah, but I'm 24 years old now. Surely the rules don't apply to adults. I can see them applying to 18-year-olds, but I'm ready for university now. Why should I need to have all this red tape? So he says, you know, I'm sorry, you know, you can't come to the University of Alberta. But here's what I tell you. He said, you go down to your car, and you've got a car, yes. You go down to your car and you drive directly from here to Mount Royal College in Calgary. And I followed his advice. I drove down there and I said, I'm here to go to university and take my high school French. I said, fine, sign me up. There was no application. There was no... he must have called. The only way I could have got in is he must have phoned and said, you take this kid. So I take my four university courses in French 30. I'm dead. Languages are not my strong point. So I never passed a single exam in French. But I did very well in my university courses. So it looks like it's game over again. And so then I write this departmental exam, for which you get 100% of your marks. And what happens? Everybody else is worse than me.
Well,
the bell, saved by the bell. I got a 65. My French teacher couldn't believe it. So, up to Edmonton I go. I'm going to be an economist, because remember I told you we were poor. And I didn't tell you, but one of the fundamental things that impacted me was my father was caught up in the web of debt and was chased by, you know, I mean, we couldn't pay the rent, we couldn't sometimes have food at the end of the month, and he would be constantly, he started off borrowing $200 from Beneficial Finance that grew to $2,500, which with the refinancing and the extra charges, you know, to get enough money to pay the loan. So that was one of the reasons, of course, I wanted to go to university, because I wanted to learn how to make money so that I would not get caught up in this web that my father had got caught in, my parents. So, you know, here I am now 25 years old, about, maybe 26, 21, no, not 26 yet. I'm still as naive and dumb as ever. So I want to go into economics, because I figure economics, they'll teach me how to make $1 million before I'm 30. So,
that's why we call it the dismal science.
So I just can hardly believe this stuff. So what do I do? Well, economics, I've got to have some calculus. Now, I forgot to tell you about... that's coming up. Yeah, I'm getting it. So, I had a 51 in trigonometry, and I haven't had any math courses in 6 years, 7 years now. And I realized that to become an economist and do postgraduate work, I'm going to have a language, and I'm going to have calculus. So I take calculus. And I take French 200.
French.
I'm a glutton for punishment. And then I take four other courses. Things like
overload.
Yeah, so I'm taking six courses that year.
Mm-hmm.
So I did literally all my work, all my studying on French and calculus. Calculus at Christmas, I got a 51. But I did attend every class. I tried hard. And I would get some help from Irene Mork. I don't know if any of you know Irene Mork. She was brilliant. So anyway, at Christmas, I got 51. And that was because the professor I drew a picture in one of the questions. I couldn't go further to calculate the area of a church window or something. I just drew the shape of the window, and that's as far as I said, I haven't got a clue what to do. He gave me 5 points for that. So,
oh, Harry, you have to publish this.
So then come the end of the year in calculus, because there were about 1,000 students taking calculus in first year at the University of Alberta. So we wrote the exam in all the calculus, all students took the same exam. And I go in and I write the exam, and I'm dead again. I just can't figure this out. You know, I can only assume one of two things happened. The professor saw some potential in me and passed me and gave me a 65. Or they had a bell curve again. Mm-hmm. I was maybe just a tiny bit better. So, but the thing is, on the four other courses, I got eights and nines. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because I was more mature. I mean, I was able to handle things like sociology, philosophy. Those courses I just loved. History.
And French.
French. Yeah, French was another disaster. How, this is the one thing about French and calculus. I attended every class and handed in every assignment, even though I didn't pass. I think there's something about French teachers who are opposite. The system is to destroy you. Because you'll have to write a paragraph or something like that, and they that might be worth 5 points, and they take 1 point off for each story. So I always got zeros.
And then your dearest colleague and his wife are French in Thai. This is so wonderful.
Well, come the end of the year, because I had tried, I got a 51. One of my good friends and one of my groomsmen and on my wedding was in my French class. I met him because he'd gone to Mount Royal. He was a little older too, and he'd gone to Mount Royal. But he was an Irishman, and he was confrontational.
Unusual.
So both of us were about the same in French. But my teacher gave me 51 and said, don't take another French course. He got a 45. So he didn't die. But again, I got very good marks in my other courses. And so, and I had taken two courses in economics, money and banking and microeconomics. So after taking those two courses, I said to myself, this is nuts. I'm not going to do this for the rest of my life. So what was my choice? My father was functionally illiterate, and my mother had grade 10 education. But I knew one thing. My mother was a bit of a status seeker. She would have loved to have a doctor or a lawyer in the family. But I didn't like the sight of blood, so that meant law. So,
maybe not. You can't get in a rock and a hard place.
So, I had no idea what lawyers did, but I knew that you had history and stuff. So I took these courses, and I applied to the law school, and because I had done well in these kind of courses, I had an interview with the dean. And we talked mostly about my Air Force career. And I got into law school, did very well in law school, and articled at one of the better law firms in Edmonton. Learned that a little bit about what lawyers did, and then came down to Camrose. And the rest is all miraculous.
Why did you come to Camrose?
That's another good story. Because I had married in my after graduating from arts. And my wife graduated that year, and she was an assistant director of nursing at the General Hospital. So she put me through law school. But we had our first child when I was in third year law. That was Lisa. And I was told by the firm I was articling with that if I wished to stay with them and be a partner, at least for the first 5 years, I would literally have to give up family life and give up that time. And if I had problems, if you had problems at the law firm, you took them home to your family. You didn't, you know, you didn't keep your problems there. So I realized that working at Edmonton was not going to be very pleasant for me and not the kind of life I wanted, because already in my third year, I just fell in love with that little baby. And my wife was working, so I was home babysitting every afternoon instead of studying. But I still did well in law. I think it's just a natural sense of it. You know, some people, I guess, I just got into the right field without knowing how it happened. And so I had to decide whether, I mean, here I am, a city boy. I've been brought up in Calgary and Edmonton. So I thought, well, I'll go to a smaller city. I would thought Grand Prairie, Red Deer, Lethbridge, Hudson Hat, Phillips. And I had done some interviews in Red Deer and thought that I would probably take that. But I was home visiting my parents, and I met Harry Andreessen on the street. And we got talking. Harry Andreessen had acted for my parents when they bought their house. And so I had a brief meeting with him. And this is the strange part, because I talked to his son about this, Bill, yeah. And I talked to him about how I had come to Cameron's. And I said, I met your father on the street. He must have been walking either to the hospital to do a will or something like that. Bill says, my dad never walks. But that day he was walking. And I was walking downtown. And we just stopped. He asked me what I was doing, how I was doing. He said, well, you know, we need lawyers in cameras. And I said, yeah, but I'm just out of articles. I'm not ready to go out on my own. And he said, well, perhaps you could join us. And I said, well, he said, I've got student loans. I've got a wife and child. I'll have to have a certain minimum salary. He said, how much? I told him, I think I could probably squeeze by on $700 a month. He said, well, I think we can do it. We've got lots of work. That's how we came to Cameron's. Now, Harry and Alec were wonderful people to work with. And so in my second year with them, I became a profit-sharing partner. But what Harry had told me, he says, I got tons of work, which was true, but he couldn't delegate. So in my first year, here I'm getting the $700 a month. I never have to work nights. I'm home with my family, and I'm building up my own practice because Harry can't. Yeah. And then I was doing a little bit of criminal law, and I got more and more in. And I, because I was a good manager, I sort of took over some of the management responsibilities. And I told Harry, I said, look, Harry, you can't charge $5 for a will if I am charging $100. You know, so I got to pay some of their fees. And I would have stayed with them probably forever, except for one thing. They never took holidays. So after I'd been with them for about 2 years, it was Easter. Easter was always good for me. I decided I'm going to my brother-in-law.
Good to the world. It was good to the world.
Yes. My brother-in-law, Ron, who had been in the RCMP in Camrose and met my sister, got out of the RCMP, went to law school in BC, finished his articles, and was opening up the first law firm with his partner in Cloverdale, BC. So he invited me out to go see them. My friend Dave, who was in my French class, was in Ron's class in D.C. and became a lawyer as well. And he was opening his law office in Langley, Fort Langley. So I'm out there at Easter, and my friend Dave, I'm visiting him as well. He's the lawyer from Fort Langley. He says, I'll take you out to a friend of mine. This is Easter Sunday. I'll take you out to a friend of mine who's just opening his office in Abbotsford. So we drove out to Abbotsford, saw this law firm. This guy and his partner were banging out a wall. We had two secretaries there, and people had been trying to discourage them from coming to Abbotsford. Here they've been in business about 3 months, and they're already doubling their space and working on Easter Sunday. That's how much business there was. That was how much opportunity there was. So I came back to Alberta, to Camrose, yeah. And Alan had just got, he'd been back for a few months from London School of Economics.
Yeah.
So as soon as I got back, I phoned Alan and I said, I've got to talk to you. So he said, well, come up for dinner. So a couple of days later, I go up for dinner, and I remember this so distinctly. They were living in a basement apartment, and the snow was still on the ground, but dandelions were growing, you know, just starting up. So Valerie had made a salad with these fresh new dandelions. Anyway, we had a nice talk, and I said, Ellen, you've got to come to Camrose, and we've got to open our own law firm. He said, okay. We shook hands on it. And then I went back and told Harry Andreessen, and he went back to his law firm. And I think they were a little upset, but now this is, we're talking about sometime, probably April is Easter. I can't remember the exact date. But we were really good to our firms. We said, look, we won't leave until 1st of August so we can finish our work and stuff like that. Alan's firm literally offered him the sun, moon, and stars. To stay, but he had said it was just on the handshake, and he said no, I committed to go to Camrose. And Valerie, of course, wasn't too keen on Camrose because she's teaching at the university in Edmonton. So, 1st of August, we open our law firm above the old Bank of Montreal because. Space that we were going to go into was not going to be ready. So it was a steep staircase. I think the bank charged us $40 a month. There were some old desks up there. There was no lights when we had our first clients. And so Alan was there a couple days before we were to open. Alan says, look, I've got some conflicts here. Harry said, we've got some conflicts here. Could Alan look after him? So I'm sending business over to Alan before we have any lights on. And so, as it turned out, in order to, I wanted to be on really good terms with Harry and Alex. So I continued working, like I would work and do my work in our law firm, but we were just building up our practice. And then I'd go to Harry Andreessen's office and finish the files I was doing. I did that. No, it became less and less until Christmas. I did that from August until Christmas, just finishing up their files. And then we also got a contract with the Agricultural Development Corporation to provide them with legal services for 12 hours a week. Just like magic. I mean, Alan and I, we fit, you know, we complemented each other. And we are best friends. Till today, and the wonderful practice. Well, I practiced with Alan for 19 years, and totally as a lawyer for 22 years, and then I was getting itchy feet. I love law, but I wanted something different. Well, I should tell you that with our two-man law firm, I took a one-year sabbatical. And I went as a special graduate student to take the philosophy of science and philosophy of law. a wonderful, wonderful year. And Alan sent me half the firm's earnings. So, I mean, our classmates couldn't believe this.
Yeah.
So then when Alec Murray, who I practice law with Andres, when he retired as the provincial court judge, I thought, well, I'll make an application. So I applied for both the Queen's Bench and the provincial court. And I was shortlisted for the Queen's Bench. And then I had gone through the selection process. With the provincial court, you go through a selection process. Names go to the government. And then I was offered the provincial court. So I have a choice. Now, the Queen's Bench were paid a lot more, but I'd have to move out of Edmonton. But do I take a bird in hand? Or gamble on getting what seemed to be a more sought-after position at Queen's Bench. And so I phoned my brother-in-law, who had been appointed a Queen's Bench judge in B.C. a few years prior to that. And I had a long talk with him. He said, Harry, I think you would be much happier in the provincial court. Which turned out right. He says, if I were you, I would take the provincial court. I wouldn't gamble on getting a Queen's Bench. Because there are a lot of political aspects to both appointments. And so I decided to take the provincial court, and that allowed me to stay in Cameron's. I mean, one of the questions they asked me is, will you leave Cameron's? I see no reason why I should leave Cameron's, because he said, well, you know everybody. You know, I said, well, the old magistrates used to know everybody too. And the argument must have won, because they allowed me to stay here. And this is, for me, just incredible. I had one of the best circuits, because, like, if I think of a northern provincial court judge having to sleep in these two-bit hotels and go these long distances, especially in winter. I was, my area, the furthest points I went to were occasionally Coronation, occasionally Rocky Mountain House. But, I mean, I could have gone anywhere in the province, and I've sat in many places in the province. But my jurisdiction is the whole province. But basically, I was centered out of the Red Deer Court, living in the Cameron's. So I was part of the Red Deer Circuit, 9 judges. So most of my work was in Wetaskiwin,